Book 3. To Charge the Spear. And now the bold historian wields into play that tome of blistering worth, where the stern monks cower under the lash, and through the high window the ashes of heretics drift down in purity's rain. See the truths stitched in thread of gold across hapless skin. I am the arbiter of lies, who will cleanse his hand in copper bowls and white sand. But the spittle on his lips gathers the host to another tale. I was never so blind to not feel the deep tremble of hidden rivers in churning torrent, or the prickly tear of quill's jab. I will tell you the manner of all things in sure proof this ordered stone row. Oh, spare me now the speckled fists, this princeps purge and prattle. I live in mists and seething cloud, and the breaths of the unseen give warmth and comfort to better the bleakest days to come. And I will carry on in my uncertainty, cowled in a peace such as you could not imagine. A Life in Mists, Gothos. Chapter 8. Whatever we're left with can only be enough if, in the measure of things, nothing is cast off, discarded on the wayside, in the strides that take us clear beyond the smoke and grief into a world of shocked birth, opening eyes upon a sudden light. And to whirl then in a breath to see all that we have done, where the tombs on the trail lie sealed like jeweled memories in the dusk of a good life's end, and not one footprint beckons upon the soft snow ahead, but feel this sweet wind caress. A season crawls from earth beneath mantled folds. I have caught a glimpse, a hint of flared mystery, shapes in the liquid glare. They will take from us all that we cradle in our arms, and the burden yielded makes feathers of my hands, and the voices drifting down are all that we're left with, and shall forever be enough. You will take my days, Fisher Kel'tath.
To slither beneath the fists of the world.
Her name was Thal, a quiet one with watchful, sad eyes. Bursting from the cloud of shards, her screams sounded like laughter. The devouring insects clustered where her eyes had been. They lunged into her gaping mouth, the welters of blood from shredded lips drawing hundreds more. Sadik cried out his horror, staggered back as if about to flee, but Badal snapped out one hand and held him fast. Panic was what the shards loved most, what they waited for, and panic was what had taken Thal, and now the shards were taking her. Blind, the girl ran, stumbling on the jagged crystals that tore her bared feet. Children edged closer to her, and Badal could see the flatness in their eyes, and she understood.
Strike down, fists, still we slide and slither. You cannot kill us, you cannot kill the memory of us. We remain, to remind you of the future you gave us. We remain, because we are the proof of your crime. Let the eaters crowd your eyes. Welcome your own blindness, as if it was a gift of mercy, and that could well be laughter. Dear child, you could well be laughing, a voice of memory, of history even. In that laugh, all the ills of the world. In that laugh, all the proofs of your guilt. Children are dying, still dying, forever dying.
Thal fell, her screams deadening to choking, hacking sounds as shards crawled down her throat. She writhed and then twitched, and the swarm grew sluggish, feeding, fattening. Badal watched the children close in, watched their hands lunge out, snatching wallowing insects, stuffing them into eager mouths.
We go round and round, and this is the story of the world. Do not flee us. Do not flee this moment, this scene. Do not confuse dislike and abhorrence with angry denial of truths you do not wish to see. I accept your horror and expect no forgiveness. But if you deny, I name you coward. And I have had my fill of cowards.
She blew flies from her lips and glanced at Rut. He clutched Held, weeping without tears. Beyond him stretched out the terrible flat waste of the glass desert. Badal then turned back to study the snake, eyes narrowing. Torpor unsuited to the heat, the brightness of the sky. This was the sluggish motion of the exhausted.
Your fists beat us senseless. Your fists explode with reasons. You beat us out of fear, out of self-loathing. You beat us because it feels good. It feels good to pretend and to forget. And every time your fist comes down, you crush a little more guilt. In that old place where we once lived, you decried those who beat their children. Yet see what you have done to the world. You are all beaters of children.
Badal,
said Rut.
Yes, Rut.
She did not face him again, not yet.
We have few days left. The holes of water are gone. We cannot even go back. We will never make it back. Badal, I think I give up. I'm ready to give up.
Give up.
Will you leave Held to the shards, to the opals?
She heard him draw a sharp breath.
They will not touch Held,
he whispered.
No, they won't, will they? Before Held became Held,
she said,
Held had another name, and that name was Born. Born came from between the legs of a woman, a mother. Born came into this world with eyes of blue, blue as this sky, and blue they remain. We must go on, Rut. We must live to see the day when a new color finds Held's eyes, when Held goes back to being born.
Badal,
he whispered behind her.
You don't have to understand,
she said.
We don't know who that mother was. We don't know who the new mother will be.
I've seen at night,
he faltered then.
Badal, the older ones, yes,
she replied.
Our own mothers and fathers, lying together, trying to make babies. We can only go back to what we knew, to whatever we remember from the old days. We make it all happen again, even though we know it didn't work the first time. It's all we know to do.
Do you still fly in your dreams, Badal?
We have to go on, Rut, until Held stops being Held and becomes born.
I hear her crying at night.
Her. This is her story. Born becomes Held. Held becomes mother. Mother makes born. Born is Held. And the boys who are now fathers, they try to go back, back inside. Every night they try and try. Rut, we all cry at night. We need to walk,
she said, turning to face him at last. His visage was crumpled, a thing of slack skin and ringed eyes. Broken lips, the forehead of a priest who doubts his own faith. His hair was falling out, his hands looked huge.
Held says west, Rut. West.
There is nothing there.
There is a great family, and they are rich in all things, in food, in water. They seek us to bless us, to show us that the future still lives. They will promise to us that future. I have seen it all, and there is a mother who leads them, and all her children she holds in her arms, though she has never made a born. There is a mother, Rut. Just like you. And soon the child in her arms will open its eyes. I dreamed of Held last night, Rut.
You did?
Yes, she had wings and she was flying away. I heard her voice on the wind.
Her voice, Badal? What was she saying? What was Held saying?
She wasn't saying anything, Rut. She was laughing.
Frost limbed the driftwood heaped along the strand, and the chunks of ice in the shallow waters of the bay crunched and ground as the rolling waves jostled them. Falash hacked out the last of her morning cough, and then, drawing her fur-lined cloak about her shoulders, she straightened and walked over to where her handmaid was building up the fire.
"Have you prepared my breakfast?"
The older woman gestured to the strange disk of sawn tree trunk they were using as a table, where waited a mug of herbal tea and a lit hookah.
"Excellent. I tell you, my head aches. Mother's sendings are clumsy and brutal. Or perhaps it's just Omtos Falak that is so harsh, like this infernal ice and chill plaguing us."
She glanced over at the other camp, 30 paces along the beach, and frowned.
"And all this superstition, tipped well over the edge into blatant rudeness, in my opinion."
"The sorcery frightens them, Highness."
"Ha! That sorcery saved their lives! You would think gratitude should trump petty terrors and imagined bugaboos. Dear me, what a pathetic gaggle of hens they all are."
She settled down on a log, careful to avoid the strange iron bolts jutting from it, sipped some tea, and then reached for the hookah's artfully carved ivory mouthpiece. Puffing contentedly, she twisted to eye the ship frozen in the bay.
"Look at that. The only thing keeping it afloat is the iceberg it's nesting in."
"Alas, Highness, that is probably the very source of their present discontent. They are sailors stranded on land. Even the captain and her first mate are showing their despondency."
"Well," Falash sniffed, "we must make do with what we have, mustn't we? In any case, there's nothing to be done for it, is there? That ship is finished. We must now trek overland, and how my feet will survive this I dare not contemplate."
She turned in her seat to see Shurkalal and Scorgan Caban approaching, the first mate cursing as he stumbled in the sand.
"Captain, join me in some tea. You too, Scorgan, please."
She faced her handmaid.
"Fetch us more cups, will you? Excellent."
"Beru bless us," Scorgan hissed. 10 paces away and the heat's melting us where we stand, but here..."
"That will fade, I am sure," said Falash. "The sorcery of yesterday was, shall we say, rather intense. And before you complain over much, I shall observe that my maid and I are no less discomforted by this wretched cold. Perhaps the Jaghut were delighted to dwell within such a climate, but as you can well see, we are not Jaghut."
Shurkalal said, "Highness, about my ship..." Falash drew deeply on her mouthpiece.
"Yes," she sighed, "that. I believe I have apologized already, have I not? It is perhaps a consequence of insufficient education, but I truly was unaware that all ships carry in their bellies a certain amount of water, considered acceptable for voyaging, and that the freezing thereof would result in disaster, in the manner of split boards and so forth. Besides, was not your crew working the pumps?"
"As you say," Shurk said, "but 100 hands below deck could not have pumped fast enough given the speed of that freezing. But that was not my point. As you noted, we have been through all that. Bad luck, plain and simple. No, what I wished to discuss was the matter of repairs." Falash regarded the pale-skinned woman and slowly tapped the mouthpiece against her teeth.
"In the midst of your histrionics 2 days ago, Captain, I had assumed that all was lost in the matter of the undying gratitude. Have you reconsidered?"
"Yes. No. Rather, we have walked this beach. The driftwood is useless. The few logs we found were heavy as granite. Mail knows what they used that damn stuff for, but it sure doesn't float. In fact, it appears to have neutral buoyancy."
"Excuse me, what?"
"Push that wood to any depth you like. There it stays. Never before seen the like. We have an ex-joiner with us who says it's to do with the minerals the wood has absorbed and the soil the tree grew in. In any case, we see no forests inland, no trees at all, anywhere.
Meaning you have no wood with which to effect repairs?
Yes, Captain.
Was this not your prediction 2 days ago?
Aye, it was. And so it has proved, Highness. And as my crew can't survive on a frozen ship, on the surface of it, we seem to indeed be stranded.
Scorgon kicked sand with his good foot.
What's worse, Highness, there's hardly any shellfish and the like in the shallows. Picked clean long ago, I'd wager. We couldn't even walk up the coast to get where you want us to go.
Most disturbing,
Falash murmured, still eyeing Shurk Elal.
Yet you have an idea, haven't you, Captain?
Maybe.
Please proceed. I am not by nature averse to adventure and experimentation.
Aye, Highness. Still the woman hesitated.
Falash sent a stream of smoke whirling away.
Come now, Captain. Your first mate is turning blue.
Very well.
Omtos Falak, Highness. Is it a true hold?
I am not sure what you mean by that question.
A hold, a place, a world unlike this one.
Where,
added Scorgon,
we might find, trees or something. Unless it's all ice and snow, of course, or worse.
Ah, I see.
She tapped some more, thinking.
The hold of ice. Well, precisely. The sorcery, as we have all discovered, is certainly cold, forbidding even. But if my education suffers in matters of shipbuilding and the like, it is rather more comprehensive when it comes to the holds.
She smiled.
Naturally.
Naturally, said Shurk Elal, to cut off whatever Scorgon had been about to say.
The commonest manifestation of Omtos Falak is precisely as we have experienced, ice, bitter cold, desiccating, enervating. But it must be understood, said sorcery was shaped as a defensive weapon, if you will. The Jaghut were at war with an implacable enemy, and they were losing that war. They sought to surround themselves in vast sheets of ice, to make of it an impassable barrier. And as often as not, they succeeded, for a time. Of course, as my mother used to delight in pointing out, war drives invention. And as soon as one side improves its tactical position, the other quickly adapts to negate the advantage, assuming they have the time to do so. Interestingly, one could argue it was the Jaghut's very own flaws that ensured their demise. For had they considered ice not as a defensive measure, but as an offensive one, had they made it a true weapon, a force of attack and assault, why, they might well have annihilated their enemy before it could adapt. And while details regarding that enemy are murky—
Forgive me, Highness, interrupted the captain, but as you noted earlier, my first mate is truly suffering. If I am understanding you, the ice and cold of Omtos Falak are mere aspects, or, I suppose, applications of a force. And, as such, they are not that force's sole characteristic.
Falash clapped her hands.
Precisely, Captain. Excellent.
Very well, Highness. I am so relieved. Now, as to those other aspects of the hold, what can you tell me?
Falash blinked up at the woman.
Why, nothing.
Nothing?
Not a thing, Captain. The only manifestation of Omtos Falak this world has seen has been ice-aspected.
Then how do you know there's more to it?
Captain, it only stands to reason.
So this notion of there being more, it's merely theoretical?
Dearest, that term is not pejorative, no matter the tone you have just employed.
Teeth chattering, Scorgon Caban said,
So I stood here for that? You ain't got a mail-spitting clue?
Hardly accurate, first mate, Falash said. It would hardly have served any of us if I'd simply said, I don't know, would it? Instead, what I have actually said is, I don't know, but I believe this to be a path worth pursuing.
So why didn't you? He demanded.
But I did.
Shurkalal turned to Scorgon. That's enough, pretty. Go back to the others.
And tell them what?
We're exploring possibilities. Falash waved one plump hand.
A moment, please. I suggest that you both return to your fellows. The explorations that will occupy me on this day are best done alone, for I cannot guarantee the safety of anyone in close proximity. In fact, I suggest you move your camp perhaps twice its present distance from us.
Very well, Highness, said Shurkalal. We shall do that. As they marched off, Falash turned to her handmaid.
My dear, she murmured, a journey awaits you.
Yes, Highness.
Gird yourself well, Falash advised. Prepare the armor and take the throwing axes. And you will need to swim out to the ship for a splinter of wood. But before all that, I wish a new pot of tea and more rust leaf for this bowl.
At once, Highness.
Gods below, Shurkalal muttered as they neared the crew's camp. But she has spectacular tits. It ever amazes me the extraordinary variation blessing us all. She glanced at her first mate. Or cursing us, as the case may be.
I wanted to stick a damned knife in her skull, Captain.
Belay such notions and stow them deep and dark. If one of the mates hears you, well, I don't want that kind of trouble.
Of course, Captain. Was just an impulse anyway, like a tick under the eye. Anyway, how could you see her tits at all under all those warm furs and such?
I could see just fine, Shurk replied. It's called imagination, pretty.
Wish I had some of that.
In the meantime, we need to allay some fears, and I expect moving us farther down the strand will put us in good stead right from the start.
Aye, it will.
He scratched at the scars puckering his neck.
You know, Captain, I got me a smell that saying that handmaiden of hers ain't as useless as she's made out to look, you know?
Brewing pots and lighting pipe bowls doesn't count for anything with you, pretty. I tell you, I'm considering finding my own handmaiden once we get home. Of course, she added, there's no rule says it has to be a woman, is there? A flush crept up the man's misshapen face. Shurk clapped him on the back. You're right about her, pretty. I'm thinking she's as mean a sorceress as the princess herself, and probably a lot more besides. That woman hides herself well, but one glimpse of her wrists, well, unless she's throwing bales of hay around when no one's looking, and given the scars on her hands those bales got knives in them, well, aye, she's more than she seems.
What's her name, anyway?
No idea. Shurk grunted. The sailors at the camp were watching them now. All right, pretty, let me do the talking.
Aye, Captain, better you and me.
And if I mess up, you can beat on some heads.
To bring 'em round, like.
Exactly. Cool beneath the umbrella, Falash watched her handmaid crawl up from the water.
You need more fat on you, dear, she observed. I'm sure the sun will warm you up soon enough, as it has done me. In any case, she gestured with the mouthpiece, the passage awaits you.
Gasping, the older woman slowly worked her way well clear of the waterline. In her right hand was a splinter of wood, black against her bluish knuckles. Behind her, in the shallows, the ice was fast melting as the last remnants of Umtos Felak faded. At the bay's outer edge, where the shelf fell away to deeper water, the undying gratitude was settling lower into a glittering, weeping nest. Once the handmaid had recovered enough to begin moving, she dressed herself in quilted undergarments and then the heavy scaled armor retrieved from bundles of waxed canvas. Taking up the paired throwing axes, a leather-sheathed short sword, an underarm holster of four throwing knives, and her helm, she completed her attire by tucking the wood splinter into her belt.
Highness, I am ready. Well said. My patience was wearing ominously thin.
Sighing, Falash set the mouthpiece down and rose.
Where did you put the last of the sweets?
Beside the brick of rust leaf, Highness.
Ah, I see. Wonderful. See how thin I'm getting? It's an outrage. Do you recall your own childhood, dear, when your chest was flat and all your bones jutted every which way?
No, Highness. I was never boy thin, thank the errant's nudge.
Nor me. I have always been suspicious of grown men who seem to like that in their women. What's wrong with little boys if they're into pallid, bony wraiths?
Perhaps it appeals to their protective natures, Highness.
Protecting is one thing, diddling is entirely another. Now, where was I? Oh, yes, throwing you into the hold of ice. Best unsheathe at least a few of your weapons, dear. Who knows what you'll land in?
The handmaid drew her axes.
I am ready.
That condescending, patronizing cow doesn't deserve tits like that, or that soft, blemish-free skin and lustrous hair. And the way those hips swing, why, I'm amazed she doesn't throw out her back with every step, and those damned luscious lips look ready-made to wrap themselves round. Gods, what was that?
The thunderclap shivered the water in the bay, set the sand to blurry trembling. Shere Khalil turned to see an enormous white cloud billowing out and up from Falash's camp. The sailors, well out of earshot behind her, were now on their feet, shouting in alarm.
"Stay here, Skorgon, and calm those fools down!"
She set off at a run. The camp was a mess, gear flung about as if a whirlwind had erupted in its midst. Princess Falash was slowly picking herself up from the blasted sand. Her hair was awry, her clothes disheveled. Her face was red, as if she'd been repeatedly slapped.
"Highness, are you all right?"
The girl coughed.
"I believe the theory has proved itself, Captain. It seems there is far more to Umtos Falak than a few chunks of ice. The passage I found, well, it's hard to say where precisely it led.
Where is your handmaiden, Highness?"
"Well, let us hope she is exploring in wonder and delight."
"You sent her through?"
A flash from her stunning eyes.
"Of course I sent her through. Did you not insist on the necessity, given our terrible plight? Can you begin to imagine my sacrifice, the appalling extremity of the service we are providing here?"
Shere Khalil studied the plump girl.
"What if she doesn't come back?"
"I shall be most displeased. At the same time, we shall have before us evidence to support certain other theories about Umtos Falak."
"Excuse me, what other theories?"
"Why, the ones about shrieking demons, clouds of madness, flesh-eating plants, treacherous voles, and 100 other nightmares in a similar vein. Now, please be so kind as to rebuild my fire here, will you?"
She reached for her last throwing knife, found the sheath empty. Cursing, she ducked beneath the scything slash and threw herself to the left, shoulder rolling until she came up against the bulk of the first fiend she'd slain. Her hands scrabbled up its muricated hide, found the wedge of one of her axes. Grunting as she tugged it free, she rolled over the body. It quivered as six swords punched into it in the spot where she'd been a moment earlier, and regained her feet in time to send the axe flying. It crunched into the demon's brow, rocking its head back. She lunged for it, tugging away one of the heavy swords gripped by the closest hand, which was twitching as the huge beast sagged onto its knees, blade clashing as she beat away the swords flailing about at the ends of the five other arms. She chopped into its thick neck, once, twice, three times, until the head rolled free. Spinning, she looked for more of the damned things. Five corpses and nothing more. Apart from her heavy breaths, the glade was silent. From one fire straight into another, she'd landed in the middle of a camp, and it was her luck that she'd been ready when they clearly were not. The fire burned on here and there, where the hottest embers had scattered. If she was not careful, she'd end up burning down the forest and all the wood the captain and her crew sorely needed. The handmaid retrieved her weapons and then stamped out the smouldering flames. She cursed as something bit into the back of her neck,
Scrabbling with one hand, she closed her fist about something small and furry, brought it round for a closer look. A vole with a mouthful of her flesh. Snorting, she flung the thing away.
"Well, Highness," she muttered, "seems I've found some trees."
Some beast shrieked close by, and the cry was echoed by a half dozen more surrounding the glade, drawing closer.
"Errant's bunghole, those things sound vicious."
Pointless hanging around here, she decided. Choosing a direction at random, she ducked into the forest. Absurdly dark, and the air was damp and cold. Plunging forward, she held her axes at the ready. A shriek sounded directly behind her, and she whirled round. Something skittered on the forest floor. Another damned vole. She watched it pause, tilt its head back, and loose another curdling shriek. A short time later, she'd left the voracious things behind. The huge boles of the trees thinned out, with more undergrowth now impeding her way. She caught glimpses of the sky, a sweep of stars, no moon. A dozen paces ahead, the ground fell away. She came to the edge, looked down into a ravine crowded with treefall, the trunks grey as bones. Clumps of low fog wandered the length of the channel, glowing like swamp gas. The channel was the product of flash flooding, and those trees had been savagely uprooted, flung down and carried along in the tumult. Studying the wreckage, she caught a shape in the ravine's gloom, 20 or so paces downstream. At first, she'd assumed it was a barrier of knotted branches and trees, but that detritus had fetched up against something else, a hull. She drew out the splinter of wood in her belt. It seemed to be sweating in her hand. Boots skidding, she half slid, half stumbled down the steep bank of the ravine. Avoiding the fog as best she could, she clambered and climbed her way closer to the ship. How it had made it this far down this treacherous winding channel without being torn to pieces was something of a mystery, but she knew enough to trust this sorcerous link. Whatever shape it was in, there would be enough of it to be of some use. At last, she reached the hull, set her hand against it. Not rotten. She thumped it, was rewarded with a faint hollow sound. 5 arm spans above her was an ornately carved gunwale, the heavy rail formed in the shape of entwining serpents running the length of the ship, which she judged to be somewhere between 15 and 20 paces. She glanced down then, to see the fog rising up to swallow her knees, and in that fog small clawed hands reached out to grasp her thighs, the talons stabbing deep, the limbs writhing like worms. Gasping at the pain, she pulled out her sword and began hacking. Her thighs were shredded and streaming blood by the time she cut herself loose and worked her way up the side of the hull, using the clutter of trees and branches for foot and handholds. Gasping, she lifted herself over the gunwale and thumped down on the slanted deck, and found herself in the midst of a squall of black-haired, scaled apes. Howling, the dog-sized creatures bared dagger-long fangs, eyes flashing lurid yellow, and raised their knotted clubs. Then they rushed her. From somewhere up the length of ravine, there came a deep, rumbling roar. But she had no time to think about that.
"My Utulu thinks this is sex. How strange."
Falash glanced sidelong at the captain, her lids slowly settling in a lazy blink.
"Back in the palace, there are exquisite mouthpieces carved in the semblance of a penis."
She gestured with one hand.
"All part of a princess's education."
Shurik set the mouthpiece down.
"Enough of that, I think, Highness. I leave you to your devices."
"Adventure arrives in all manner of guises, Captain. Had your Utulu a brain, I am sure it would most avidly concur."
"But that's the whole point about, desire. It's mostly brainless. Most of the world's tragedy is found in this one misunderstanding. We tie too much to it, you see. Things like loyalty and precious intimacy, love and possession, and sooner or later it all goes wrong. Why, I knew men, and I do mean new, who'd come to me twice a week hungry for the brainless stuff.
and afterwards they'd babble on about their wives.
What would they tell you? Please, I must know.
Starved for gossip, are you?
The palace seems terribly far away at the moment.
Just so, Highness. Well, some would tell me about all the sorcery of love being gone between them, the embers of desire cold as stone now. Others would complain about how complicated it had all become, or how rote, or how fraught. And still more would talk of their wives as if they were possessions, to be used when it suited the men, and otherwise left alone. But the very notion of those wives perhaps doing what the husband happened to be doing, there with me, well, that could light a murderous rage in their eyes.
So, while being with you, most of them still missed the point?
Very astute, Highness. Yes, they missed the point entirely.
Because what you offered was sex without complications.
Exactly.
Brainless.
Yes. And that freed them, and freedom made them happy, or anyway forgetful, at least for a short time. But once the flush was past, well, that old world and all its chains just came rattling back down. They'd leave as if they were condemned to swim the canal.
You have led a varied and extraordinary life, Captain.
Life? Wrong word, Highness.
Oh, one doesn't have to be breathing to be alive. And before you comment on how ridiculously obvious that statement seems, I do implore you to give it a second consideration, as I was not referring to your condition.
Then I am indeed curious as to what you might mean, Highness.
In my years of education, I have...
A roar drowned out her next words, and they swung round to see a torrent of muddy, foaming water pounding into the bay just beyond the shallows. Rushing from a gaping wound almost swallowed in gouts of steam, the flood thundered aside the slabs of floating ice, clearing a broad swath. A moment later, what seemed half a forest exploded out from the wound, snapped branches and sundered trees. And then the prow of a ship lunged into view, outward like a thrust fist, and then plunging down to the bay's churning waters. The raucous flow drove the ship straight for the reef.
"Erin's bitch!" swore Shurkelal.
Abruptly, in wallows of spume and steam, the ship heeled, came about, and they saw a figure at the stern rudder, pushing hard against the current. The wound thundered shut, cutting off the wild flow. Branches and logs skirled in the spinning water. Falash watched the captain run into the shallows. The strange ship had crunched briefly against the coral shelf before pulling clear. It was fortunate, the princess decided, that the seas were calm, but it was obvious that one woman alone could not manage the craft, and that disaster still loomed. Glancing to the right, she saw the crew pelting along the strand, clearly intent on joining the captain. Falash looked back to the ship.
"Dearie, couldn't you have found a prettier one?"
Spitting out silty water, Shurkelal pulled herself onto the deck. Something slimy beneath her boots sent her down onto her backside with a thump. She held up one palm. Blood. Lots and lots of blood. Swearing, she regained her feet and made for the bow.
"Is there an anchor?" she shouted. "Where's the damned anchor?"
From the stern, the handmaid yelled back,
"How should I know?"
Shurk saw her crew now plunging into the shallows.
"Good."
"We're drifting back to that reef,"
the handmaiden cried.
"How do I stop it doing that?" "With a damned anchor, you stupid cow!"
Failing to find anything and feeling somewhat bad about her outburst, Shurk turned about and began making her way back to the stern. One clear look at the handmaiden stopped her in her tracks.
"God's woman, what happened to you?"
"It's the damned voles," she snarled. "This, that thing, is that what you call a sea anchor?"
Shurk forced her eyes away from the woman to where she was pointing.
"Male's kiss, aye, it is."
5 quick steps along, she halted yet again.
"Is that water I'm hearing below? Are we taking on water?"
The handmaiden leaned on the rudder's handle and looked over with red-shot, exhausted eyes.
You're asking me, Captain?
Shurik whirled, reached the landward gunwale, glared down at her thrashing crew.
Get aboard, you lazy pigs! Man the pumps, fast!
Back on shore, Falash settled down on the log, careful once more to avoid the iron spikes. Drawing on her hookah, she watched the antics with some contentment. As she exhaled a stream of smoke, she heard and felt a rattle in her throat. Almost time for her afternoon cough. He kicked his way through the clutter, the crumpled helms, the crushed iron scales, the bones that crumbled into dust and lifted grey clouds to swirl about his legs. Ahead, across an expanse of level land buried in corpses, was a mound of the same twisted bodies, and from the top of that mound rose the trunks of two trees, bound at the center to form an upright X. The remnants of a body hung from it, flesh in shreds, black hair hanging down over the desiccated face. Silchas Ruin could see, even from this distance, the long shafted arrow buried in the figure's forehead. Here, in this place, realms folded one upon another. Chaos and madness in such profusion as to stain time itself, holding horror in an implacable grip. Here the skin of 100 worlds bore the same seared brand. He did not know what had happened at this battle, this slaughter, to leave such a legacy, nor even the particular world in which the actual event had taken place. He slowly crossed the killing field towards the mound and its grisly shrine. Other figures moved about, walking as if lost, as if seeking friends amidst the faceless thousands. At first he'd thought them ghosts, but they were not ghosts, they were gods. His passage caught the attention of one, and then another, and then still more. Some simply looked away again, resuming whatever it was they were doing. A few set out to intercept him. As they drew closer, he heard their voices, their thoughts.
A stranger, interloper. This is not his world. This is not his curse. This is nothing to him.
He comes to mock us. The fragments of us snared here.
He does not even hear the cries that so deafen us. All these chains of desire.
And despair, Shedinul. So much despair.
Silchas Ruin reached the base of the mound, studied the twisted bodies before him, a steep slope of solid bone, leathery flesh, armor and shattered weapons. A half dozen gods gathered around him.
Tist Leosan? No, Beru. Tist Andi. His white skin mocks the darkness within him.
Does he belong in the war? He is dangerous. We don't want him anywhere near us when we slay the fallen one, when we feed and so free ourselves.
Free? Growled one in a thick, heavy voice. Maori, from the legacy of our followers, we shall never be free. This is the bargain we made. I made no such bargain, Decembre.
Nevertheless, Beru, mortal desire gave us shape. Mortal desire dragged us into all their realms. It was not enough that we ascended, not enough that we should seek out our own destinies. I tell you, though most of me still walks a distant world, and his howls of betrayal deafen me, in curse and prayer I am knotted here like a fist. Do I desire worship? I do not. Do I seek ever greater power? I have been shown its futility, and now all my purpose settles like ash upon my soul. Here we are trapped, and so we shall remain. Because that fool master sanctified Kamensal's theft. The fallen one was wounded, made useless with pain. And with that master's cursed blessing, he raised the house of chains, and with those chains he bound us all.
Decembre snorted.
Long before the first rattle of those chains, we were in shackles, though we amused ourselves by pretending that they did not exist. The master of the deck and the fallen one dispelled the illusion. No, they dispelled our delusions. And with them all their sweet, precious convenience. I do not need an upstart like you telling me all I already know. You do, when you would feed your reason with false indignation. We shall soon gather in another place, little different from this one, and there we shall commit murder. Cold, brutal murder. We shall slay a fellow god. Before his heart is sundered, before the unknowable woman can ever reach the fallen one, or attempt whatever it is she intends, we shall kill him.
Do not so easily discard that woman, Decembre,
said a new voice, a woman's, thin and crackling.
She is sibling to the master of the deck, a master who hides himself from us all. How can this be? How has he managed to blind us to his whereabouts? I tell you, he hovers over all of this, as unknowable as his sister. This wretched family from that wretched empire.
A cane crackled against bones, splintering them, and Silchas turned to see that a new god had arrived. Indistinct, a smear of shadow.
Decembre, this one hissed. And dearest Jess, Beru, Shedenul, Maori, Bekra, Thilander, see how you crowd this tist, Andy. This brother of Anomander Rake? Do you imagine he cannot hear you?
The cane jabbed at Decembre.
Look at us, so fey in reflection of our once mortal selves. The Empire, yes, our Empire, Decembre. Or have you forgotten? That wretched family? Our very own children.
Oh, look around, Shadow Throne,
snarled Jess, her face of skeined wool, cotton, hemp, and silk, twisting and knotting as she bared web-shrouded teeth.
The wreck has come and gone from this place. She knows and makes for us a true path. Your damned children cannot hope to defeat us. Leave them to the Fokrul Asael. May they devour each other!
Shadow Throne giggled.
Tell me, Jess, do you see your cousin anywhere near? Where is the Queen of Dreams in this place of death? She hides! She is not here, Jess,
said Shadow Throne,
because she is awake. Awake! Do you understand me? Not sleeping, not dreaming herself here, not plucking all your mad tales, Jess, to confuse mortal minds. You are all blind fools.
You mean to betray us?
Shrieked Shedinul.
I care nothing for any of you,
Shadow Throne replied, with a laconic gesture of one ethereal hand.
Betray? Too much effort over too little of worth.
You come here only to mock us?
I am here, Beru, because I am curious. Not about any of you. You're nothing but gods. And if the Asael succeed, you will all vanish like farts in the wind.
No, my curiosity is with our unexpected guest, Artist Andy.
The cane waved at Siltra's ruin.
Oh, brother of heroes, why do you bless Coltane's eternal fall with your presence?
I seek a weapon.
The two you carry are not enough.
For a companion. This battle you all seem so eager to join, I could warn you against it, but I admit that I see little use in that. You are all determined to join the fray, leaving me to wonder.
Wonder what? Demanded Beru.
When the dust settles, how many of your corpses will I see upon that field?
Silchas Ruin shrugged.
Do as you will.
Your brother slew our strongest ally.
He did. And of what significance is that to me, Beru?
You are as infuriating as he was. May you share his fate.
We shall all share his fate, Silchas Ruin replied.
Shadow Throne giggled.
I have found you a weapon, but only if the one who wields it is worthy.
Silchas Ruin looked round.
From this place?
No, not from here. There is nothing to the weapons here but memories of failure.
A sword appeared from the shadows, swirling round the god and clattered at the Tist Andi's feet. Looking down, he drew a sharp breath.
Where did you come by this?
Recognize it?
A hust. But no, he hesitated. I feel that I should, knowing well that sacred forge. The draconic theme is distinctive, but the ferules remind me of hust's earliest period of manufacture, and I thought I knew all of those so made. Where did you come by this?
Of little relevance, Prince. You note the draconic theme, do you? What is the term? Pattern weld? So you might think, to see those scales glittering so prettily along the length of the blade.
He giggled.
So you might think.
This weapon is too good for the one I intended to arm.
Indeed? How unfortunate. Perhaps you could convince your friend to take the ones you now wield. And for yourself, this singular weapon. Consider it a gift to you from Shadow Throne.
And why should you so gift me? Silchas Ruin asked.
Perhaps the others here bemoan the loss of Hood. I do not. He was hoary and humorless and ugly besides. Thus, if I cannot convey my best wishes to Hood's noble slayer, then his brother shall have to do.
Siltras Ruin looked back down at the hust sword.
When we were children, he muttered, he used to steal my things all the time because he liked to see me lose my temper.
He paused, remembering, and then sighed.
Even then he was fearless.
Shadow Throne was silent. The other gods simply watched.
And then, Siltras Ruin whispered, he stole my grief. And now what is there, I wonder? What is there left to feel?
If I suggested gratitude, would that be insensitive?
Siltras Ruin shot the god a sharp look and then said,
I accept the gift, Shadow Throne, and in return I offer you this.
He waved at the other gods.
This mob ill suits you. Leave them to their devices, Shadow Throne.
The god cackled.
If I was bloodkin to this family, I'd be the uncle slumped drunk and senseless in the corner. Luckily, dare I risk that word, I am not kin to any of them. Rest assured I will humbly heed your advice, Prince.
Siltas Ruin picked up the weapon.
He looked at the gods, his crimson eyes slowly moving from one ghastly face to the next, and then he vanished. Decembre wheeled on Shadow Throne.
What was all that? What scheme are you playing at?
Shadow Throne's cane snapped out, caught the Lord of Tragedy flush across the bridge of his nose. He stumbled back, fell onto his backside. Shadow Throne hissed and then said,
The best part of you wanders the mortal world, old friend. Long ago, he surrendered that emptiness called pride. At last, I see where it fetched up. Well, it seems one more lesson in humility shall find you.
He glared at the others.
All of you, in fact.
Beru growled.
You snivelling little upstart!
But then his voice fell away, for the Lord of Shadows was gone.
Busy, busy, busy.
Cotillion paused on the road. It's done?
Of course it's done.
Shadow Throne snapped and then grunted.
Here? What are we doing here?
Recognize the place, then.
Pah! Not more regrets from you. I'm sick of them.
I am marking this site one more time.
What, like a hound pissing against a fence post?
Cotillion nodded. Crude, but apt.
What of you?
Shadow Throne demanded.
Did you return to Shadow Keep? Did you send her off? Did she need a few slaps? A punch in the nose? A quick Roger behind the keep?
She needed only my invitation, Amanas.
Truly?
Of all the wolves on one's own trail, Cotillion said, there is always one, the pack's leader, cruel and relentless. Show me a god or a mortal with no wolves on their heels.
Enough talk of wolves. This is me, after all. Fanged, eyes of fire, foul fur, and endless hunger. 100 beasts, each one named Regret.
Just so, Cotillion nodded.
So you put her on a horse and gave her a blade and sent her back down her own trail.
To kill the biggest, meanest one, aye. Shadow Throne grunted again.
Bet she was smiling.
Find me a fool who'll take that bet, Cotillion replied, smiling himself. The Lord of Shadows looked round.
See none hereabouts? Too bad.
The air filled with the cries of gulls.
Tist Leosan, the children of Father Light. A star is born in the dark, and the heavens are revealed to all.
Withal ran his hand along the pitted plaster, fragments of damp moss falling away where his fingers scraped it loose. The painted scene was in a primitive, awkward style, yet he suspected it was more recent than those glorious works in the city's palace. Light like blood, corpses on the strand, faces shining beneath helms, a sky igniting.
A few survived the chaos, the civil wars. They cowered here in this forest. In colored plaster and paint, they sought to make eternal their memories.
He wondered why people did such things. He wondered at their need to leave behind a record of the great events witnessed and lived through. Sure enough, a discovery like this, here in the forest above the shore, at the base of a vast sinkhole his errant step had inadvertently discovered, well, it led to questions and mystery, and, like the missing patches and the thick clumps of moss, he found a need to fill in the gaps.
For we are all bound in stories, and as the years pile up, they turn to stone, layer upon layer, building our lives. You can stand on them and stare out at future's horizon. Or you can be crushed beneath their weight. You can take a pick in hand and break them all apart until you're left with nothing but rubble. You can crush that down into dust and watch the wind blow it away.
Or you can worship those wretched stories, carving idols and fascinating lies to lift your gaze ever higher, and all those falsehoods make hollow and thin the ground you stand on. Stories, they are the clutter in our lives, the conveniences we lean upon and hide behind. But what of it? Change them at will, it's only a game in the skull. Shaking the bones in the cup to see if something new shows up. I imagine such games are liberating, and the sense of leaving oneself behind is akin to moving house. A fresh start beckons, a new life, a new host of stories, a new mountain to build stone by stone.
What makes you happy withal?
Long stretches of time, Sand, free of alarm.
Nothing else?
Oh, beauty, I suppose. Pleasure to caress the senses.
You play at being a solid and simple man withal, but I think it is all an act. In fact, I think you think too much about too many things. You're worse than me, and before long, all that chaos gets so thick it starts looking solid and simple.
Woman, you make my head ache. I'm going for a walk. Rubbing at his bruised hip, he brushed twigs and mud from his clothes, and then carefully made his way up the sinkhole's side, grasping roots, finding footholds from the blocks of cut stone hiding in the gloom. Pulling himself clear, he resumed his journey down to the shore. 20 or more paces up from the strand, the forest edge had been transformed. Trees cut down, trenches dug in banked ripples facing the imminent breach in Lightfall. Figures swarming everywhere, weapons in heaps, swords, spears, and pikes, with Shake and Lethary crews busy scrubbing the rust from the ancient iron, rolling new grips from strips of soaked leather. The wood of the hafted weapons seemed to have been unaffected by the passage of time, the black shafts as strong as ever. Hundreds of helms formed vaguely disturbing mounds here and there, awaiting oil and refitting. Working his way past all this, Withal reached the strand. He paused, searching among the crowds, but he could not find the one he sought. Seeing a familiar face ahead, he called out, "Captain Pithy!" The woman looked up. "Where is he?" Withal asked. She straightened from the leather map she'd laid out on the sand, wiped sweat from her face, and then pointed. Withal looked in that direction, saw a lone figure seated atop an old midden, facing Lightfall. With a wave to Pithy, he set off in that direction. Yedan Derig was taking bites from a lump of cheese, his jaws working steadily as he studied the cascading light. He glanced over as Withal approached, but only briefly. Boots crunching on the ghastly white bone fragments of the beach, and then the slope of the midden, where amidst larger pieces of bone there were husks of some forest nut, more recent gourds and pieces of pottery, Withal reached the prince's side, whereupon he sat down. "I didn't know we had any cheese left." Yedan plopped the last bit into his mouth, chewed a moment, swallowed, and then said, "We don't." Withal rubbed at his face. "I expect to feel the salt, the freshened sea breezes. Instead, the air feels as close as the hold of a ship." He nodded to Lightfall. "There is no breath from this, none at all." Yedan grunted.
"There will be soon enough."
"The queen was wondering about that."
"Wondering?"
"All right, fretting. Well, more like a cornered cat, come to think of it. So not fretting at all, snarling, all claws out, fear blazing in her eyes." Yedan's jaws bunched, as if he was still chewing cheese, and then he said,
"Is that what you wake up to every morning, Withal?"
He sighed, squinted at Lightfall. "Never been married, have you? I can tell."
"Not much interested."
"In any of that?"
"In the women."
"Ah. Well, among the Mekros, men marry each other all the time. I figure they see how men and women do it and want that for themselves."
"Want what, exactly?"
Someone to be the cat, someone to be the dog, I suppose, but all official-like.
And here I thought you'd go on about love and commitment withal.
No, it's all down to who lifts a leg and who squats. And if you're lucky, that goes back and forth. If you're unlucky, you end up trapped in one or the other, and life's miserable.
Your winning description of marriage, withal, has fallen somewhat short for me.
Sorry to hear that, Yedhan.
Something to do, I suspect, with the lack of sincerity.
Withal grinned. Anyway, the Queen is eager for reassurance. Do you feel ready? And how soon?
There is no true measure of readiness until we are engaged, withal. Until I can see what my army can do, or is willing to do. Of the two, I will take the latter and hope for the former. As for how soon, he paused and then pointed at Lightfall. There, do you see that?
A strange dull spot formed in the descending streams of light. It bled outward like a stain, reaching down to the very base before the brighter edges began soaking back in. What was that?
Dragons, withal.
What?
Soul taken, or allies. The sorcery of the Elaint that some call their breath. They assail the barrier with that chaotic power, and with each breath the ancient wound thins, the skin weakens.
Mail save us, Yedhan. You mean to stand against dragons? How?
When the wound opens, it will be at the base, to open the way for their foot soldiers. A beachhead will need to be established. We need to be driven back from the wound. For a dragon to physically come through the breach will take all of its power, and when it does, it will be on the ground, not in the air. And when a dragon is on the ground, it is vulnerable.
But if the beachhead has driven you back,
we must in turn overrun them.
To reach that first dragon?
Yes.
And kill it?
Ideally, halfway through the wound, and not killed, but dying. At that moment, my sister and the witches need to pounce, to take that draconic life force
and seal the breach. Yedhan Derig nodded. Withal stared at the man, his angled profile, his dark, calm eyes fixed so steadily upon Lightfall. Beru's sweet piss, does nothing rattle him? Prince Yedhan Derig, your soldiers will look to you, and now at last I begin to see what they will see. You are their own wall, their own Lightfall. But are you wounded too? Yedhan, can it be done, what you describe?
The man shrugged. My sister refuses to kneel before the first shore. It is the act that sanctifies the Queen of the Sheikh, and she will not do it.
Why ever not?
His teeth bared in a brief grin, Yedhan said, We are a contrary lot, us royals. A queen who defies sanctification, a prince who will never produce an heir, and what of Awakening Dawn? What of our Sister of Night? Gone, forever gone. Yan Tovis and me, we are all that's left. Have you ever been in a Lethary city, withal?
Well, yes.
Have you ever seen a sheikh walk through a Lethary crowd?
No, I don't think so.
They keep their eyes on the cobbles. They shift and slide from anyone in their path. They do not walk as would you, tall, filling the space you need.
I believe that has changed, Yedhan. What you and your sister have done here.
And sticking a sword in their hand and telling them to stand here, to fight and to die without a single backward step, will turn mice into snarling leopards? We shall find out the answer to that soon enough.
Withal thought for a time on all that the prince had said, and then he shook his head. Is it just your royal blood, then, that makes you and your sister the exceptions to the image you paint of the sheikh? You are not mice.
We trained as officers in the Lethary military. We considered that a duty, not to the King of Lether, but to the Sheikh. To lead, we must be seen to lead, but more than that, we needed to learn how to lead. This was the Lethary military's gift to us, but it was a dangerous one, for it very nearly swallowed up Yan Tovis. Perhaps it has, given the reluctance she now displays.
If she does not kneel to the shore, asked Withall, can the witches alone seal the wound?
No.
And if there were more of them?
Yedan glanced over. If I hadn't murdered them, you mean? He seemed to find something left over in his mouth, worked it loose with his tongue, chewed and swallowed. Hard to say. Possibly, possibly not. Venal rivalries plagued them. It's more likely they would have usurped my sister or even killed her, and then they'd set about killing each other.
But couldn't you have stopped them?
I did. Withall was silent for a moment, and then he said,
surely she understands the danger.
I imagine so.
You've not tried to persuade her?
In her own way, my sister is as stubborn as I am.
Another wall, Withall muttered.
What? He shook his head.
Nothing of import.
There, another pass comes. Look.
A dark shape was descending behind Lightfall, a thing huge and blurred, lunging to sweep past the heart of the wound. Something struck the barrier like a massive fist. Light sprayed like blood. Red cracks spread out from the dark stain. Yedan stood.
Go back to the Queen of Carcanus, Withall, he said, drawing his sword. One more pass, if that, and then this begins.
Begins? Withall asked, as if struck dumb.
He saw Pythian Brevity running up the strand. A sudden chill flooded through him. Terrible memories of his younger days, of battles upon the decks of the Mekros. Fear weakened his legs.
Tell her, continued Yedan, his tone as steady as ever, we will hold as long as we can. Tell her, Withall, that once more the Sheikhs stand upon the shore. Spear points thrust out from the wound, a shivering, bristling horror. He could see figures pushing, crowding, could almost hear their howls. Light spurted like ropes of gore. Light flooded out onto the strand, illuminating the crushed bones. Light lit faces beneath helms.
Tist Leosan, the children of Father Light. A star is born in the dark, and the heavens are revealed to all.
Go, Withall. We are breached.
We can hold against nothing. We can only crumble like sand before the devouring wave. Yedan calls to his officers. His officers rush and shout. Ranks form up. These would-be soldiers struggle and steady themselves. The Sheikh, my Sheikh, stand pale, eyes wide, straining to see what's happening at the breach, where the Lethary, dreaming of riches, meet the thrusting spears. Screams now rise from the wound. There are Tist Leosan, their faces broken masks of fury, and all the madness of war is down there at the breach. Life's blood even now spilling down. We cannot hold. Look at my people, how their eyes track my brother now. But he's only one man, and even he cannot defeat this enemy. Long ago, there were enough of us, enough to hold, enough to last and to die to save this realm. But no longer.
Pullian's squish loomed in front of her. They were shouting, screaming, but she was deaf to them. The clash of weapons grew desperate, like a thousand knives upon a single whetstone.
But you are flesh, my brother, not a whetstone, flesh.
You must kneel.
Yan Tovis frowned at the young woman before her.
Is it blood you want?
Eyes widened. She held out her wrists.
This? You need to kneel before the shore.
No,
she growled.
Not yet. Go away. I'm done with you. The islanders are fighting.
Go down to them, kneel yourselves, in the sand beside the wounded and the dying, both of you. Look in their faces and tell them it was all worth it.
Jan Tovis lunged forward, pushing them so that they staggered.
Go, tell them! You want me to kneel, to sanctify all of this? Shall I be yet one more ruler to urge my subjects to their deaths? Shall I stand tall and bold, shouting fierce promises of glory? How many lies can this scene withstand? Just how empty can words be?
Kneel,
she whispered.
Yes, everyone, kneel.